House Civil Law Committee will come to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Do I have a motion on the minutes? Representative Hortman has moved the minutes from March 21st. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. First bill on the calendar, House File Quadruple X. 1780. Thank you, Representative Huntley. The chair will move House File 1780, Miscellaneous Data and Civil Law Provisions Related to Health and Human Services Policy. And I'll move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay. So, Representative Huntley, if you would just walk through the bill as amended.
The amendment related to some changes that were made in the Health and Human Services Finance Committee on Friday. And I have Emily Cleveland here from House Research to go through the bill. We have people from the various departments, and I will say the probably the most controversial part of this is Article 7, which relates to how we set home and community-based service disability rate settings. And all that means is we used to have the counties individually do it in every different county, and the federal government has ordered us to have one uniform statewide rate setting for that particular area. And the Department of Human Services has been working very closely with the various providers on this issue, and they have not quite yet reached the compromise, but they're still working, and they've got about 95% of it done. They've got a little bit more to go, and with that, we're here because there are many privacy issues in this bill, and what you have before you is the section of my Health and Human Services Finance Bill that has anything that relates to data and privacy.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Cleveland. Well, Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, there's no Article 7 in our bill.
Did you just make an Article 7, Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, so I have a note here that said it was in there, so apparently it's not. What? It's in the amendment.
It's in the A1 amendment we passed, Representative Holbert.
What page number would really be helpful?
20. Okay, Ms. Cleveland.
Mr. Chair and members, so I'll do a quick walkthrough of the bill, and then I'll point to where things changed in the amendment also. Article 1 is related to redesigning home and community-based services. In this article, it modifies the disability linkage line, senior linkage line, long-term care consultations, and the common entry point for reporting maltreatment of vulnerable adults, and then creates a community-first services and supports. And I think Mr. Gehring will, some of the language in the bill is directly related to this committee's jurisdiction, and some of it was included in the bill for context so you can understand when a proposal had, more thoroughly what the proposal was. And Mr. Gehring, I think, will point to the ones that are specifically of this committee's concern.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Cleveland. And members, I understand some of the language in this bill for context, but the chair does not intend to entertain a lot of discussion about those contextual issues, but only about the issues that are here for the purpose of civil law jurisdiction. Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, so in Article 1 of the bill, there are two sections. There are a lot of miscellaneous sort of data and civil law things that are kind of scattered throughout the bill, but what I'm going to do is highlight the substantive ones. So in Article 1, Section 1, on page 20, line 13 to 29, there's provisions related to background check procedures for individuals involved with community first services and support providers. And also in Article 1 in Section 3, which is on page 21 and 22, there's language that requires common entry points for reports of suspected maltreatment of vulnerable adults to maintain certain types of data. It also requires tracking and reporting mechanisms to be available to the Commissioner of Human Services related to these reports. Those are both data privacy issues. Specific language is on page 22, lines 24, through page 23, line 11.
Ms. Cleveland.
Mr. Chair and members, then Article 2 is related to the Department of Human Services program integrity. These three sections all relate to background studies and information collected at the Department of Human Services.
And Mr. Chair, so in Article 2, Sections 1 through 3 all have, as Ms. Cleveland pointed out, provisions related to background checks, including the Commissioner of Human Services, access to updated court records databases for the purposes of conducting those background checks, and some requirements that the data be transferred between the entities electronically.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Cleveland.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 3 is related to waiver provider standards. This modifies human services licensing provisions and the home and community-based services standards.
And Mr. Chair, there's a lot of sections in Article 3 that are sort of context-based sections. Specific data and civil law provisions include Section 5. There's record requirements, which you can find on page 37. This section establishes standards for record keeping by certain human services license holders, including protection against loss, tampering, or unauthorized disclosure, the license holders are subject to requirements in Chapter 13. And there's also requirements in this section related to certain types of data that must be maintained by the license holder on individuals who receive services from them. There are requirements related to access to those records and requirements related to maintenance of personnel records by a license holder. In Section 7, Subdivision 3, which is on page 45, there's data practices language that requires license holders to provide intensive support services to establish data privacy policies and procedures.
Ms. Cleveland.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 4.
Representative Paymar.
Chair, as long as it's in this committee, I just a question about the. Are you developing a new system to manage the data for background studies, or is this, I would assume that you have an existing system, but it says you shall develop and implement an electronic process. I'm looking in Article 2, and I'm just wondering how that either currently or will interface with the criminal history system that the BCA has.
Ms. Cleveland?
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, I believe the Department of Human Services has staff here to speak substantively.
I mean, I don't know if we need to get into it, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if you're creating a new system. You know, it's been a subject of concern around here for a long time that we've been putting a lot of money into these database systems, and some of them we keep putting a lot more money into because they're not working properly, and other systems aren't able to speak to them, if you will.
Please introduce yourself for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Laura Plummer-Zarest of the Department of Human Services, Office of Inspector General, Licensing Division. And we are the division that conducts background studies under Chapter 245C. And what this provision is talking about is, in addition to the system that we have now, background studies that we conduct under the law, this is connecting us with the Minnesota Court Information System to obtain that information. What we've been, you may have heard us refer to as a wrap back, ultimately looking at being able to get information on individuals that we do studies on, have already done studies on, to look back at any new criminal information. And this is really related to a federal grant that we received from CMS, and it's part of that, getting ready to do that.
Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Paymar?
Well, I'm just Mr. I'm sorry, I missed your name, but are you creating a new system? Is what the question I have.
Is it Ms. Plumeroff? How do you say your
name? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Laura Plummer-Zarust.
Plummer-Zarust.
It's a mouthful.
Thank you.
We are not creating an entirely new system. We have a system now. Of course, we check with the BCA and check their records. What we're doing is creating an interface, an automatic interface with the Minnesota Court Information System. We've been working with them. We have access to that data, but this is to obtain like a daily, input of records from the MNSA system. So it's an interface with them, and we have been working with them. It's not an entirely new background system. That is in place under 245C, which does include checking with the BCA, as you, I believe, was part of the question.
Okay.
Representative Paymar.
I'll leave it for now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Plummer-Zarust. Okay, so Ms. Cleveland, please continue.
Mr. Chair and members, then Article 4 is the Health Department's home care providers proposal. This is changes to the licensure of home care providers. And the A1 amendment on the pages 1 through 22 on the A1 amendment replaced language that was amended on Friday in Representative Huntley's committee, so that language is before you in the A1 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, specific data provisions in Article 4 include sections 1 through 3 on page 46 to 47. Each of these sections classify data specifically as private or confidential and regulates the release of private or confidential data on home care providers. There's a new section that would be added to the bill by the A1 amendment on page 1, which specifies data that must be submitted in an application for a home care provider license. Page 5 of the A1 amendment, there's a section related to surveys and investigations, which specifies procedures and data that must be used in conducting surveys of home care providers. You can see this language specifically in subdivisions 1 through subdivision 6 on page 5 of the A1 amendment. In the bill, on page 62, lines 27 to 31, there is language related to an appeals process for appeal of civil penalties assessed related to home care providers. You can see that in subdivision 4. Starting on page 62. And then additionally, line 64.33 to 65.22 contains language that permits injunctive relief and grants certain subpoena powers to the Commissioner of Human Services. On page 65 of the bill, in section 10, there's language related to background checks for home care providers. On page 70 of the bill, subdivisions 6 and 7 contain language related to records that must be kept by home care providers that relate to maltreatment of vulnerable adults and minors, and also some language related to maintenance of employee records by home care providers. On page 83 of the bill, section 17, there's language related to client records requirements for home care providers. Page 90 of the bill, lines 22 to 23, there's language that specifies maintenance of personnel records and supervision activities also related to home care providers.
Ms. Cleveland?
Mr. Chair and members, then the last article is Article 5. These are sections related to the Department of Health. The A1 amendment took out most of this article, all of the sections related to changes to the vital records system, which is the birth and health records. Those sections were removed from Representative Huntley's bill, so they're removed here also. So all that remains are sections 12 to 14 of the bill related to alkaline hydrolysis. These are mortuary science provisions and requires licensure of facilities that do this method of chemical cremation. And then section 18 is the state-based risk adjustment system. And this would require the Commissioners of Health, Human Services, and Commerce, as well as the Board of MNSHR, to study whether or not it would be feasible to do a Minnesota-based risk adjustment.
Thank you for your for the bill walkthrough. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Sure.
So just a couple of sections to highlight in Article 5. As Ms. Cleveland pointed out, most of the civil law and data provisions have been removed by the A1 amendment, but on page 112, there is language related to civil immunity for licensed alkaline hydrolysis facilities. And then on page 118, in section 18, this is the state-based risk adjustment system assessment language, which does contain language that requires collection of certain data to conduct risk adjustments, which includes, in some cases, data that could identify an individual or collection of features of an individual's specific health plan. That language is on page 120, lines 8 through 14. Additional data practices sections include in Article 6 in the A1 Amendment, page 26, there's sharing of data between the Commissioner of Human Services and the Department of Education related to analysis of autism spectrum disorder treatments. And then Section 3 on page 28 of the A1 Amendment, there's language that requires development of strategies for managed care plans to provide access to developmental and social emotional screenings of children between the ages of 1 and 3 and reporting of data on those plans and statistical results of the screenings. And then finally, in Article 7 on page 30 of the A1 Amendment, there's language related to types of data used to do rate determinations for home and community-based services disability rate setting. And Mr. Chair, that's the highlight of all the data and civil law provisions in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. And before we go to questions from members or other testimony from the public, I believe Representative Norton has an A2, is it A2 amendment? I think Mayo is here. They got to be here. I can smell the money. So, Representative Norton, if you want to come up and explain your A2 amendment. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The version, what you have in front of you is based on a version that was rolled out last evening by the Tax Committee and the staff that helped rework the Destination Medical Center portion of the tax bill. And so we were just given this last night, and the point of the treatment of data division, which I think is what you're primarily focused on, was to delineate in statute that all of the state and city funds, all the bonding funds that are used for the Destination Medical Center will be subject to open meeting law requirements, with the exception of any monies that are related to private investment or funds that might be a benefactor might give to the corporation for private development, that those books don't need to be open from the private corporations, but that all the planning and the finances, the public money finances, will all be subject to open meeting laws. So that's what this section does, and I think both Mayo's counsel and the staff that drafted the language are here to answer further questions.
Okay. Are there questions for Representative Norton from members of the committee? Representative Holberg.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton was kind enough to bring me this language last night on the House floor, and I think this is really unprecedented in its approach. We have lots of areas of government where you have the private sector intersecting with the public sector, and Chapter 13 has carved out many things that aren't made public in trade secret information. There was a Met Council bill a couple years ago that said donor lists or donor information is not public, and so I don't know enough about the Mayo project to see, to understand fully, given the how little time we've had with this, to be able to figure out how this would even work in practice, given that you're going to probably have commingling of funds in some instances, and I don't know how you would even begin to draw this bright line operationally, and I'm very uncomfortable with this approach. It would be, I think, far better to see where the current data practices standards are not adequate to protect those things that they want to be protected and carve out those exceptions, as opposed to this attempt to put things into two separate buckets, which inevitably they're going to intersect at some point.
Okay, thank you, Representative Holberg. Other questions or comments from members? Okay. Representative Paymar.
I just wanted to be clear about the open meeting law. So what meetings are all meetings for the medical center, Destination Medical Center, obliged to follow the open meeting law, and those wouldn't just be board meetings. These would. What are you? What meetings are under this section?
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, and perhaps the attorney here with me would like to weigh in, but that the planning portion, that the board meetings and the planning are open, and also members, and you may not know this, but the any planning that is done also has to go to the City Council for approval, and those are all open to the public, and there's public input at that portion too. So there may be planning done, and of course those board meetings of the corporation are open, but the final decisions are all made at the City Council level, and those meetings are open as well.
There is an attorney who has taken a seat at the table. Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, my name is Lynette Slater-Crandall, and I am with the Dorsey & Whitney Law Firm. I serve as bond counsel and economic development counsel to Mayo Clinic. And Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, that's correct. This is a somewhat unique entity. It is actually creating a public nonprofit corporation under Minnesota law, which is prohibited unless there's currently a general prohibition on such entities being created. However, this is a unique situation where a special purpose entity would be organized by the city to manage the public funding that's financing the public infrastructure that supports the Mayo and other private development in the city of Rochester. And that's, again, to support the Destination Medical Center Initiative. The intent is not to exempt this public nonprofit corporation from any open meeting law that would apply to the city or any other public entity. The unique factor here, and to address Representative Holbrook's question, is that because of Mayo's position and ability to leverage some benefactor capital, the existing Data Practices Act is somewhat unique in that it doesn't seem to contemplate exactly the types of situations that we may be facing with private benefactors who normally aren't making significant contributions to public entities, but often those donors wish to be anonymous. I'm aware of the provisions, Representative Holberg, that you cite as to when, based on receipt of a subsidy with a private developer, information may become public or may remain protected. To be honest, with respect to the treatment of data, this is Representative Lynchesky's language, and we just took a look at it last evening, but I believe it serves the goal, again, of protecting the benefactor capital. But again, certainly anything that relates to the establishment of the development plan, expenditure of the public funds, would fall under the Data Practices Act, and there wouldn't be any special exemptions for that.
So I have a question then, Ms. Slater-Crandall. So what is the line of demarcation by which a benefactor would have the benefit of this provision as opposed to not having the benefit of it? I mean, if I donated $50 at a blood drive fundraiser or whatever, I'm assuming, I mean, I don't know what they would be for this, but whatever it was, would I receive the benefit of having my information private, or do I need to just give like over $1 million or something?
Mr. Chair, in the language that House Research has prepared for Representative Lynchesky, I don't see any benchmark as far as dollar amount. What they've attempted to do is categorize it based on the contributor, essentially, of the funds. So if we are talking about city funds, whether it's city tax increment financing or city levy or city local option sales tax, whether it's county money, there is a county transit tax provision in Representative Lynchesky's bill, or whether it's the state funds, which is the state aid formula that that has been proposed, all of that would be public data. And excuse me, I shouldn't say public data because I know there are very specific definitions here. It would be treated as public funds otherwise would under the existing law. Additionally, anything related to the development plan, which is pursuant to the expenditure of the public funds would again fall under the existing law. So there's not an attempt to present any dollar threshold or otherwise keep that data outside of the existing statute, unless again it's based on the benefactor.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Ms. Crandall, you mentioned that this is the creation of a public nonprofit. Do you know of another recent or really any example of that? I'm trying to think if maybe one of the stadium or ballpark authorities fall under that. I just can't remember.
Ms. Slater-Crandall.
Representative Simon, Mr. Chair, no, those are actually political subdivisions of the state. Public nonprofit corporations have been used in bond financings over the years. Excuse me. They were often done, to be quite honest, to create an ability to finance something that a political subdivision couldn't do on its own. A number of years ago, our state auditor decided that was not good public policy and prohibited that. That's actually not the situation here. I believe that Representative Lincheski, and I won't put words in her mouth, but again, I think the intent is to create, again, a special purpose entity, not actually a political subdivision, but a nonprofit that could leverage the private benefactor capital, which is something that Mayo Clinic has represented, that they have had significant conversations and believe that there are significant opportunities for private benefactor capital. And so I believe that's why this structure with a nonprofit, I believe it would be probably organized as a 501c3, so with the benefit of the tax exemption for the donors.
Ms. Slater-Crandall, does Rochester have a port authority or similar economic development corporation? And if so, why would that not qualify and meet the needs?
Mr. Chair, Mayo Clinic and the city have had discussions about that. I think the concern is that their existing economic development entity does have a broader mission that is citywide. It's not focused specifically on the Destination Medical Center initiative. And as Representative Simon noted, for these special purpose projects, we often create special purpose entities in the state. We've done it for the ballpark, for the stadium. We do it for watershed districts. We do it for a number of different reasons. I believe there are literally hundreds of them, and the state auditor has a report on those. So the intent here is to create a singular entity that could be focused on the Destination Medical Center initiative without competing priorities in the city.
Representative Simon.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, on Subdivision 6 on line 2.9, so I'm not as concerned about the open meeting law. I think you have that pretty well covered, at least to my satisfaction. But starting on line 2.9, that framework makes sense to me if there is an adequate system in place to track the spending of public dollars. And so what you're saying is it's not government data unless, and the unless is data that relate to or document the corporation's receipt, investment, or expenditure of money provided by these public sources. I can understand it would be pretty easy to track and make public the receipt. But I'm wondering, and I know this is coming together very quickly, and it's all in people's minds right now. We don't know how this entity is going to act. But Ms. Crandall, Representative Norton, how do you envision this new entity keeping track of investment or expenditure, especially because it's going to be commingled with other money? In other words, if the Lesch Foundation gives $3 million and the public gives $10 million, how are you going to figure out, and I know I'm asking you to really speculate here because this thing doesn't exist, but how just generally do you envision being able to segregate that and say this sewer was paid for by the Lesch Foundation and this and this other infrastructure improvement was paid for by the public money? How are you going to be able to segregate that, understanding that this is speculative and it doesn't exist yet? But do you have an idea about that?
Ms. Slater-Crandall.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I can speculate. I think maybe two options. I believe there could be separate accounting funds for the public dollars and the private dollars within the nonprofit corporation. That wouldn't be unusual. We're used to that when we do bond financings anyway, because there are restrictions on the bond proceeds that wouldn't be applicable to other funds, so separate accounting funds would be one option. But again, I think with respect to the expenditure, the existing rules of the game would apply when we're talking about making a grant or a loan to a private developer, or when we're talking about making a grant to the city to widen the street, or as you said, to improve the sewer system. all of the tracking of those funds, I would presume, could be accounted for as specifically dollar by dollar from the city, the state, or the county, to the extent that those are within the nonprofit corporation. But there could be essentially a line item for, you know, other private funds, again, without disclosing a restricted gift from a benefactor.
Mr. Chair, I guess my only request would be, given the nature of the entity and given the fact that significant public sums, particularly state money, is going to be expended here, I think the more segregation and specificity and precision we can have, the better in terms of going forward. I know this entity is being sort of created somewhat on the fly to accommodate a lot of concerns here, but I think in order to make this framework workable, you'd have to have that separation so that people really can see how the public money is being spent, particularly with the inevitable commingling from public money and private or other sources.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I think that's a wonderful suggestion, and thank you for bearing with us as we've absorbed this language over the last 12 hours or so here. But I do believe that it meets the goal, and I think that your direction is very realistic, because again, we'll have multiple sources of funds that may be again tax exempt bond proceeds, taxable proceeds, other funds from the city or the county that may have other restrictions as well. And so I think a detailed accounting system within the nonprofit corporation will be essential and certainly a part of the plan.
Ms. Scott, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern with this is twofold. Again, the rushed nature of it and the lack of time for sunshine on this. My second is that this amendment is really not germane to the Health and Human Services bill that it's being amended to. So those are my concerns with it, and I understand the rush nature, but this is such a unique, attempt to do something different than what we've ever done before at the legislature. It makes me very nervous, the rush nature of all of this, and especially as Representative Simon pointed out, the commingling of funds and this public nonprofit, and you were on untreaded water here, and it just, the rush nature of this really gives me great concern. So really more of a comment than anything.
Ripson Norton.
Well, I would just say I appreciate Representative Scott's comments. However, I would point out that while this is a little bit different language than we had, this whole concept is not new, and we've had these same discussions prior to the new language that came in about that there will be private and public funds together. So we've been talking about this all along and not in this committee, so I apologize. And frankly, we just wanted to make sure that this was aired in the right committee before we move forward. So we did our best, given the short notice, to get it before you today. So I apologize for that, and I just want to let the committee know that the community of Rochester has been watching this with interest, and trust me, they want the open meeting process to take place. They will be watching very carefully, and they have been very clear in our community that they plan on having a voice in what happens in our community as this moves along.
Thank you, Representative Norton. In this committee, we always follow the sage advice of Ronald Reagan, trust but verify. Representative Holberg, did you have?
Hi, Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Let me just pose a what if, and then you can respond as far as could this be possible. Because you want to completely shield a whole segment of operation of this, could you conceivably have a situation where private benefactors, say a group of doctors, put up private funds to build a particular facility that would benefit them financially, and all of that would be shielded on the private side of this, and then have the public funds build the parking ramp, the street, and all the improvements for that facility?
That was a question for who, Representative Holberg? Ripson Norton.
Well, I would just say, and I'll let the attorney weigh in on the legal part of it, but I do know Mayo Clinic has very strict laws about what their doctors can and can't make money on. So they would, Mayo Clinic is, I don't know if Lynette knows the answer to this, but they do have very strict laws, and actually has been somewhat detrimental as we tried to roll out intellectual property things in our community, that Mayo has a very tight hold on their physicians and what they're able to do publicly. But
Ms. Clerk,
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, and I apologize that I can't comment on the internal conflicts of interest policy that Mayo Clinic would have, but what I can tell you about the structure of the bill is that what the state of Minnesota is investing in really is the public infrastructure that will support the private development. So there will be Mayo Clinic investment estimated at approximately $3.5 billion over the next 20 years, in addition to over $2 billion of other private capital, which will be building things that essentially make Rochester a destination city and support the Mayo Clinic mission. But what we're talking about here, the project costs for which the public funds could be used, and if there are private funds, which indeed we hope there are, channeled through the public nonprofit corporation, all of that money would be spent on the type of infrastructure that's currently authorized for expenditures under Minnesota law. So what your port authority in your city could spend money on, what the Economic Development Authority or Housing Redevelopment Authority in your communities could spend dollars on. And so to the extent that this body then is making those decisions, it's doing it pursuant to an adopted development plan after notice in a public hearing. It's doing it based on the membership, the board that's established here, and again, subject to open meeting laws. So I'm not sure that I can answer any better than that, but I wanted to make sure that this committee understood exactly what this public nonprofit corporation would be undertaking in the city.
Well, Mr. Chair, with a complete blackout of information about the private side of this entity, you have no checks and balances. You have no clue whether a relative of somebody on the board is contributing large sums of money to this process. You have no clue whether private donors stand to benefit financially from a particular investment. You have no clue whether private investors are steering a particular money or putting strings on it to their benefit. There is no sunshine around large, which I would hope would be large portions of the funding of these projects. And I don't think that that's a good way to operate. I think that we do have current standards in the data practices laws that protect donor lists, allow for anonymous contributions under Chair Bell. The Met Council was pursuing a program for private investment in the Metro Park system. We had a lot of discussion about, you know, how this would work. I'm just very, very nervous with a project of this size where you wall off a major portion of the financial activity of it for no sunshine whatsoever, that there's lots of, the appearance, number one, is not good just to begin with, and I don't think it's appropriate to ask for this major investment by state tax dollars and not have more sunshine in the process.
Let me ask a question, Representative Norton. With a lot of the other big projects that have come along, these kinds of things have been worked out over the course of years. And I know for most people at the legislature, they were aware of the DMC in September, and we started to have hearings on it this legislative session a couple months ago. These kinds of things, the little devil in the details type of things, have been worked out over years, and this one I think just came to light. When did it come to light? Was it last night when you saw the language of this? When did you realize that this needed to go in front of the Civil Law Committee? Or if not you, who made the decision that this should be a provision of the DMC legislation, and why?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, we had discussion before this language was put in about the interaction between public and private. That's been discussed all along the process. So that part isn't a new discussion. This particular language was worked on over the weekend. I finally saw a final copy of the bill yesterday afternoon, and it was brought to my attention yesterday afternoon that this was going to have to go before the committee, or late yesterday morning, and I started talking with Charlotte and others about how we might do this in an open and fair way. So it's all very last minute. The staff that drafted the language is here in the room, and you can talk with them about the course of the weekend, how this came into being, but it was news to me as of yesterday.
Okay. Well, Ms. Slater-Crandall, you had a comment on that?
Mr. Chair, yes. I was just going to add that there have been conversations, significant conversations in the other committees who have had jurisdiction about the benefactor capital, and the reason that this has arisen is because there was a slightly different structure where there was actually a Destination Medical Center authority, a political subdivision of the state with the same board makeup and some of the same functions, but it was actually a political subdivision. There was also the concept that there would be a private nonprofit economic development corporation in the community that could leverage the private capital and would also be making some grants and participating in funding. So that private nonprofit would not have been subject, again, because it wouldn't be receiving any public funds. It would only be raising private dollars. It would not have been subject to the Data Practices Act. And so with this collapse, essentially, of the political subdivision and the private nonprofit, now we're left with a public nonprofit. So I believe, in good faith, Representative Lencheski and her staff tried to find a happy medium here. And I can say that we'd be happy to continue to talk with you and look at the existing protections more closely in the Data Practices Act to see what might be covered that would not necessitate the new language here. But I believe, again, in policy and concept, we have generally had discussions with members that you know, the ability, again, to protect the privacy, if you will, of the private benefactors who may not want their dollars advertised or you know, the privacy of donors is very real in the philanthropic community. And so that's been the goal. But again, we'd be happy to work with you to address the questions that you've raised today.
Thank you. Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, just for follow-up, Representative Norton, if there was a member of this public board and their immediate family member donated $10 million of private funds to this project, would you view that board member should disclose that as a possible conflict of interest?
Ms. Slater-Crandall.
And if so, if you had all this data walled off, would they be able to?
Ms. Slater-Crandall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I'm just looking at there's a conflicts of interest provision as well here, which relates to the membership of the public nonprofit. It actually ties to their affiliation with the Mayo entity, however. So I presume, you know, again, what we're talking about here is expenditure of private dollars, I suppose, that could happen, that don't happen very often with public entities in the state. Your local EDA or HRA doesn't usually get significant contributions from private individuals. They direct those through 501c3 nonprofit entities typically. And again, those are the dollars that we're trying to leverage here. If they wanted to protect the information, if they couldn't, I suppose it would be a risk of whether or not those funds would be expended for the public purpose on the public infrastructure, and perhaps we just have less dollars to deal with. I can't speak to, I guess, the existing burden that would be on a member with respect to conflicts of interest outside of what's specifically listed in Subdivision 5 here, but I'd be happy to work with House Research and better understand those and explain those to the committee as a follow-up.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Holbrook.
My question was for Representative Norton and her what she would support with this legislation.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. And I'm not an expert in a lot of this, but I can tell you, having spent my lifetime serving on public boards, it's not at all unusual for board members to gift funds. But if they do, they need to recuse themselves from how those funds are spent and not be part of a control over how that money is used. It is simply a gift. And I do think, at least my experience on nonprofit boards has been that there are plenty of laws that govern nonprofit boards already that would have to be followed. And so, you know, my experience on boards would say I can gift money, but as far as a vote and directing that money to my personal interest is limited. So I would have to go back to my book of nonprofit corporate boards and review them, but I would think they need to recuse themselves from any action resulting from that donation.
Are there other members of the public who wish to be heard on the A2 amendment? Rep, I see Mr. Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister, would you please take a place at the table?
Yes, sir.
And members, it is the chair's intent to vote on this in short order here because we've taken 45 minutes on this. So, Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. An old adage, similar to Mr. Chairman, you said of Ronald Reagan, one that I've learned around here is, what's the problem and what are you trying to fix? This is an overkill of what you're trying to fix if it's based on, oh, we want to make sure that private benefactors don't have their names to the public. Well, it's been like this, Mr. Chairman, for decades at the University of Minnesota, and other entities have given anonymously millions of dollars to multi-million dollar organizations like the university. You are wanting to, that there's an effort to put $500 million in public monies in Rochester, and granted it's a statewide interest. But with the bill you have before you is one that segregates the blood of finding out what government does. And what that blood is data, information. You can have all the open meeting laws you want, but it's the data where you follow the money, you follow the trail. You know, I just celebrated my 58th birthday yesterday.
And one Happy of the birthday, things, Mr. Neumeister.
Pardon me?
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And one of the things I learned in my political astuteness I've developed over the years was the old Watergate adage, follow the money. And if you can't have sunshine and accountability with that, it raises a number of issues. So the approach that's being taken by Representative Norton and other folks, and you know, again, the kinds of public questions I've asked is, well, who are the people, who are the lawyers that developed the statute or the proposal? Mr. Chairman, members of the committees, you and folks who've been here for hundreds of years, when you add age all the years you've been here, you know that sometimes legislation that comes in from various folks come from a different perspective, and they're being brought to you for the first time. And so it needs a little bit of rough and tumble kind of discussion on that. Some other points I want to add to you about the board. There are basically five public members of this board, two appointed by the governor, a couple other by the mayor, and then the county board and the city. So it's already taken an entity of a public thing. One of the other things is that I think it's very clear is that there is broadness of language where it can be left up to people to the discretion of what they define as financial business or other data that should be released. I think the approach can be, Mr. Chairman, is take a look, take a step back, take a look at what there are similar kinds of laws, particularly like with the benefactor, the trade secret kinds of things. I remember the old triple... Representative Schoen was one of the first big corporations. It was a project of Governor Perpich, where there was interaction of private money, investment, and public money. It was called the Greater Minnesota Corporation, or whatever it was, back in the late 80s. And I remember working, and others, the news media, who may not even know about this amendment, or other public groups. They worked out a situation where there was private investments and all that. Granted, there may not have been anonymous donors, but the University of Minnesota can have their anonymous donors. I think there can be some, at least some standards where you can craft things to where you don't cut off the blood, which is data for public accountability and sunshine with this bill. So, Mr. Chairman, I can just, those are some just some high points, whether or not something can be worked, you know. The inertia takes over now. The inertia of legislation takes over. You add this on, inertia happens, And will there ever be more of an opportunity to do that? I don't know. But that's up to you and to you as political leaders.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Questions, comments from other members? Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, so Representative Norton, you just heard what Mr. Neumeister said. I think some of us probably share those views. And what are you going to do about it?
Representative Norton.
Well, thank you. And there would be two points I would make here. The staff that drafted this language didn't come from Mayo Clinic. In fact, their language looked very different from this. So I would like to remind the folks around the table that this was the staff that helped draft this language over the weekend, and they did so based on their history of experience with the other projects in the state, of which many have been referenced here, Mall of America, Vikings, Twins, other port authorities, and a lot of the language in the bill that's not in this subdivision is kind of plunked from the port authority type authority that's going to be given to the city of Rochester. So I would say that is one point to remember. And the second is, even though the names and the books of the businesses or benefactors that might give money are going to remain closed in this, and I can tell you from the months of discussion with Mayo, they need to be, because otherwise they're not going to be benefactors and donors from the private sector, because they don't want to open their books in the public process. But we have made certain through this language that the public books will be open, not the private books. But each and every plan is approved through a public process, and each and every plan, the development plan that goes through here, is open to the Sunshine Law. So everything that's being developed, even though some of the funding may come from a different source, that come from a private source, the whole public process is still public, and the dollars from the public will follow that in a very public manner, both on the board, the DMCC, as well as the city council, who will vote on each and every revision as it moves forward. So there's plenty of sunshine.
I have Representative Paymar.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not so satisfied with the answer, because listening to Representative Holberg, I mean, this is a very different arrangement. And I would ask you to think through the implications of what we're doing here, because there are some decisions that Mayo could be making with their private money that hinges on the public money, where that sunshine will not shine, where the sun won't be shining. And some of those internal decisions maybe should be open to public scrutiny, and not just the monies that are state monies or county or city monies that are furthering the expansion of Mayo, because some of the I have no clue exactly what Mayo's planning on doing in the next 15, 20, 30 years with all of these projects, and now would be the time to at least set some groundwork for how we make this process as open as possible, because the funding, quite frankly, is commingled in many respects, even though you're articulating it differently.
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, I think there continues to be confusion. The Mayo Clinic development is separate from the DMCC development. Mayo Clinic is going to invest ahead of the game with their own money and their own means. This money and the public infrastructure will follow that, not precede it. So while there may be private and public benefactor money private or benefactor money that may go into the DMCC project, that's not Mayo Clinic buildings. So there are differences here in the upfront investment on Mayo Clinic and what's going to follow in this DMCC plan.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to do anything to impede the progress of your bill, Representative Norton. I think that, you know, this has been a controversial issue, and I think it would behoove you to try to find some language that provides the most sunshine and openness and accountability if you want public buy-in and buy-in from the legislature.
I would agree.
And I'm not sure you're there yet.
Thank you.
Well, I hear you, Mr.
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, I have heard, and more importantly, I hear from my community. So we have tried along the way, and as has Chair Lynchusky, behind the scenes been working, because this plan is not what Mayo laid out. In fact, it's changed significantly to address the exact concerns you're talking about. And I'm very open to continue working and hearing what you have to say. But I am invested, obviously, as the author of the bill, and the major, wonderful facility I have in my community.
Representative Norton, You're going to have to keep working on it because you've done a great job on this. I have no idea how you tackled this big of a project with so many different facets. This is just one tentacle of it that you're wrangling with right now, and we know you've done a lot of work on this. But as it stands now, there are questions about this tentacle in this committee. If we vote on this now, it will not make it through committee. So I'm going to leave this up to you. If you want the chair to lay this bill over and ensure that we do work on it continually, or if you just want to vote on it today and roll the dice and take your chances with a negative vote in committee on it.
Representative Lesh, I'm not sure how to respond to that. This is language we've been working with the governor's office, and I don't know the specifics of the things you're grappling with in this committee and how individuals feel. We certainly don't want to lose, have a negative vote on something that, you know, we fully anticipated being in the tax bill this year and how that would roll out. I don't understand the mechanics of that. So I guess I would tell you that we hope for a positive vote. We hope this will be in the tax bill. We will continue to work with the governor's office and the Senate and you to get the concerns right, and I have to trust that you will take action in this committee that would help me move in that direction.
Okay, and I understand that, and it's not my interest to stand straight in the way of progress either. But there are just so many different facets of this, and this one has not been fully vetted. It just hasn't, based on the questions. So the chair is going to lay the bill over. I'm sorry, it's not a bill. Chair is going to go ahead. Representative Leland.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I didn't want to let this go without weighing in on it a little bit as well. And first of all, I want to say I appreciate very much the concerns that have been raised in the committee. And I want to reiterate with Representative Norton that these are many of the very same concerns that we've been grappling with and that our community is grappling with, because certainly the concern about following the money and understanding who's doing what, who's spending money where, is one that we are all seriously grappling with. And you will have my commitment and Representative Norton's that if we can move forward with this today, that we will continue. And this bill has a long way to go. And I know that this committee doesn't like to let something go before it's in the form that it really should be in. But believe me, this is going to change. And I want to make sure people understand what Representative Norton is saying here, that we started with the original bill, and as the chair noted, we only found out about this in September. It came in here in bill form late in January, if I recall. So this has been a very quick process. Extraordinary when you look at the size of this project and the complexity of the project. What you have before you is very different and much more protective of the public's interests than what it started out. And that is in large part due to understanding among members that what Mayo was asking for originally, which was really a lot of secrecy, if you will, a lot of protection of what they wanted to do and really a lack of transparency, that wasn't going to be acceptable here in the legislature. So there is a real movement here. And what Representative Norton is trying to do is to protect the interests that all of us feel as public officials in our obligations to the citizens that we represent to make sure that things are done right. And I very much appreciate what Representative Holberg articulated. And I agree with her that we need to make sure that a proper balance is struck here. But we don't want to give the message that we're not interested in the $3 or $5 billion of private investment that we're potentially talking about here. And so we want the opportunity to move forward with the bill. We're on a very short timeline in terms of getting on with the omnibus tax bill, which is actually being discussed right now. And but we in no way intend to drop this issue and just, we also, I think Representative Norton and I feel very strongly that the public's interest needs to be protected here. And not only in Rochester, but because this can set a precedent across the state. And so I would just ask the committee and really ask members to please let us move on with this piece, knowing that you have our commitment to seriously working on it further. so that we don't impede the progress of the bill here today. And I think Mayo is listening and is understanding very clearly that there's a standard here to be met in the legislature, and that we're all going to have to step up to try to figure out what that proper balance is so that they can move forward with the investments that they want to make at the same time protecting the very, very serious public interest in making sure it's done right.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Huntley, aren't you doing Representative Mueller's committee this morning as well? Are you? Do you have another stop? You don't? Okay.
No.
Well, Representative Mueller lied to me.
Not that I know of.
I just want to make sure that on the bill in total, which is a piece of the larger bill, and we're talking about amendment to this piece of the larger bill right now, which we spent a half hour on, and I've got four members that want to speak, so I'm trying to be sensitive about the time, yet knowing full well that this issue needs to be vetted since it's the first time it's been vetted at all. So I've got Representative Scott, Paymar, Simon, and Holberg. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess what I would encourage the committee to do is to lay this over, have the bill's author and Mayo and the parties that share this concern to work on this bill in the next couple of days pretty intensely. And then we can meet again and look at the new language. We can break and do that. I think that's the prudent thing to do here. And without rushing things through, and it reminds me of the Viking Stadium deal last year and pushing everything through. And when you do that, there is a lot of lack of sunshine. I really appreciate you bringing this to our committee, but I really think that maybe that's the route that I would like to see it take. Thank you.
Representative Paymar, you just spoke. Did you have another comment? Or?
Well, yes.
Go ahead,
Representative Paymar. Well, Mr. Chair, if it's the will of the committee to work on the amendment additionally, I think that's the will of the committee. I would hope that we wouldn't have to take a vote on that. And I would also, I guess my opinion is I'd like to move the bill forward. And I think we can, I believe Representative Liebling and Norton will work on this language. And that would be my preference. Is that we move the bill forward. I think it can get worked out.
Representative Simon.
I just want to echo that, Mr. Chair. I hope that we move it forward, too, and I realize that in saying that, I'm sort of making the case for what you're not normally supposed to do, which is sort of move things along, and we're trying to get away from that. But I say that because this isn't a civil law bill or even a data practices bill, and if Representative Paymar had a public safety bill, or Representative Portman had an energy bill, and it had to make a stop in a committee because of one tiny provision, and that committee, because it was dissatisfied with that one tiny provision, held up a big public safety bill or a big energy bill, that author and any of us would be justifiably frustrated by that. That's not to minimize what we do in this committee. It's an important committee. But this is a big piece of legislation, and for us to hold it up over a paragraph that we momentarily disagree with, I think veers a little bit on the petty in the sense that we all have some misgivings. I do too, but this is a big bill, and the message we're sending by saying we're parking it here until we're all satisfied over five lines of text, I think we can do better, and I think we have to have a little bit of trust here. So I think we should just consider that when bills stop in ancillary committees that don't pertain to their main subject area, and we've all had bills like that, I think that committee has to pay a little bit of respect to the author and to the main thrust of the bill. So I don't favor laying it over for that reason.
Well, Representative Simon, just to be clear, we do not have Representative Norton's entire bill here. We just have the amendment affecting the data provisions that Representative Norton sought to add to the Health and Human Services omnibus finance bill. And so if, in fact, we did park the amendment here, not the bill, we haven't asked the question of what problems would that cause for if they were to pass the entire DMC bill this year, what kind of problems would that cause for not having the data provisions for donors? But maybe that can be addressed in a second. But Representative Holberg, did you have another comment, or I'd just go to Representative Holberg? Representative Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I might agree with you had there been a bill, had there been a notice. I don't even know when this amendment was posted. This is unprecedented policy, and data practices with a major investment in the state. The rest of the business community probably isn't aware of this. Privacy advocates, I mean, who even knows that this is being discussed this morning? It's not the author's fault. Stuff moves around here, but something this big involving this much money and this big of a policy change should have a notice. The public should be able to come in and weigh in on it. Once this leaves here, that doesn't happen, and we don't get good data practices policy without discussion from all components involved. And today we have Mr. Neumeister here because he happened to be concerned about things in the health bill, not because of this issue. He became aware of it at probably 8:10 when I gave him a copy of it. I guarantee you that there are other people in the state of Minnesota that would like the opportunity to weigh in on this and to just push it through. And I don't know what staff worked on it. Mr. Gehring shook his head. It wasn't him. I don't know what if it was tax staff or whatever, but this is unprecedented in its approach. And I do not think we will get a good policy if this is the last of the discussion in the public realm. There's a data practices bill that could carry this language with an amendment on the floor. There's lots of opportunities once there's some consensus around this issue, but this issue deserves more input from people that aren't sitting in back rooms here having discussions. We as a committee, this is an important issue, and the more people that are involved and contribute to the resolution, the better the solution will be.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know who can answer this, and maybe no one can, because the short time fuse of getting this amendment, I didn't get the chance to research why we have provisions not to allow these types of organizations currently, and why we have concerns over these types of organizations. So without it given the, can someone answer why this, what the concerns are and why this, these aren't allowed currently, and why we don't have an item that looks just like this? I mean, why don't we have private, public organizations currently? Isn't this kind of a unique animal?
Well, Representative Howe, I think it is, I mean, as has been stated, and as has been stated by the testifiers who are proponents, that yes, it is a new thing. And what I've heard from Ms. Slater Crandall is that the reason is that their donors would not give money if this had to follow the normal rules under Minnesota Chapter 13.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so therein lies my concern, is that we have provisions out there that have concerns about this type of organization, and we haven't given real good, haven't had a chance to really review this and take a good look at it and put in place items that could guide us in the proper way to handle an organization like this. And without the time to do research on this and put that into the amendment, I think we're doing a injustice to all of our citizens out there that rely on us to do good policy.
Representative Paymar.
Oh, Mr. Chair. So, okay. So now I'm sort of, I've been mixed about what you want to do here. So I maybe you want to restate your intent here and
my
what you would like.
Representative Paymar is to withdraw my amendment until the players can get together and talk about what the concerns are. Now, I will say this, that the players getting together may not necessarily be what this particular amendment needs, in light of the fact that past concerns of this magnitude have been kind of vetted in the public square, meaning a committee or on the House floor over the course of years. And here, this amendment was posted at 6:15 last night, and it's being discussed in Civil Law Committee this morning. And I don't know if withdrawing the amendment now would be adequate. Representative Paymar.
Withdrawing the A2, the A2, Mr.
That's
Chair.
Right.
Withdrawing the A2.
It's just
okay,
A2.
So following a little bit on what Representative Simon was asking and Representative Holberg, so the bill is moving along, but we're voting on it in Tax Committee. tomorrow, right? So are you anticipating that by the time the tax committee votes on this, that that language will be vetted again by this committee, or what's the process going to be? I have no problem holding off on this particular amendment to work it through as long as the bill moves forward. I'm just trying to get when would be the opportune time or the best time to amend the altered amendment back onto the tax committee.
Well, we run into a bit of a problem, Representative Paymar, because if I ask Representative Norton or Ms. Slater-Crandall, which people aren't going to give you the money that you need to get started if we fail to pass this amendment, you're going to say, well, that's the point. I'm not going to tell you who, because they don't want to be known. They want to be secret. So we're in a catch-22. If I even ask the question that is relevant for purpose of discussion of how much are they going to be short on their project if we don't pass this, because certain people won't give money unless it's secret, who are they, and are you not going to get your project? And they say, well, we can't tell you who they are. So in my opinion, no, this issue would not be resolved prior to the tax committee vote on it. And they would need to testify to tax committee, yes, we still plan to go forward, or, well, no, without this provision in, we're short $500 million or something. But my intent is that these issues that have concerns in this committee get resolved, that will take more time than we have in 24 hours.
Mr. Chair, so just, again, to understand, so let's just say that the bill moves forward without this amendment and taxes tomorrow. Then what? Are you going to reconvene this committee to discuss whatever language the parties come up with?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. And Mr. Chair, could I ask Representative Norton if she's okay with that?
Representative Norton, is it okay if Representative Paymar asks you if you're
in fact, I'll just ask you.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, I guess I would just say this bill and the transparency that it provides is such a far cry closer to what my community and what I think folks that I heard on the tax committee wants. I would be very sad if it doesn't move forward. Can it be better? It probably can, and we'll continue to work to see that it is better. And if it could get out of this committee, I can commit to trying to find some better language to put in while it's in the tax committee, and it gives us a couple more days. I'm not certain. What I can tell you is I asked some of these very same questions, because I'm not an expert in this area at all, of the tax chair when she was suggesting that this is what the direction they were going to go. And the tax chair assures me that there are other port authority type organizations, Mall of America and some of the others, where there is investment privately, and they do manage to keep it quiet, and it's not even in statute. So to that end, I think she and the staff felt that this was protective of the private investment that needs to move forward. And frankly, just for your information, that private investment, it's not even that will hurt the Destination Medical Center Corporation, is that these are companies that are coming to our state to build buildings and develop that we, the state, are going to lose the opportunity to get their tax revenue. So I'm really torn. I don't want to make a recommendation to this committee because you're the experts in this. I can just tell you I will commit to continuing to work, and I hope we can continue to move it forward, because I do think not having this in there will upset people in my community and the tax committee, because they're the ones that suggested a lot of this. So it's maybe not perfect, but it's better than the bill that was in its original form.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, this is not direct. This whole amendment is mostly government operations provisions and a little bit of data. And this is the bill has been heard in government operations, but in very different form than what is being presented here. And as my conversation with Ms. Dyson, there really is a restructuring involved. I'm not saying that this new version should be reheard in that committee as well, but I think those same large issues related to how this is structured and organized deserve more than just the tax committee's input. The tax committee is nice on taxes, but they don't deserve more than just the tax committee's input. The tax committee is nice on taxes, but they don't necessarily have responsibility for everything that we do. So I don't know how we're going to make sure you get buy-in on the structure of this and the way these two entities are going to relate to each other, but the fact that the civil law may take some more time on data may also potentially could give you more time to work on the government operations provisions as well.
Seeing no other comments from members, Representative Norton, the chair is going to withdraw the amendment, and we will work together. We'll follow up with you over the course of the next few days. I am on tax committee, so if there are questions about that on tax committee, I can answer them then. Chair withdraws the amendment. Back to the bill as amended with the A1 amendment. Is there any other comments from members of the public regarding the bill as amended? Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, I thought I heard you ask for testimony from the public. You just said...
Is there testimony from the public? You did, Representative Holbrook. Is there testimony from the public? Oh, as Twyla Braze is on the list. Thank you. That's what you're referring to. Thank
you. Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions, but if you want to go testimony first.
Go ahead, Ms. Braze. Please introduce yourself for the record. Just so I know, is there any other testimony, individuals from the public who want to testify on this today? Okay, thank you. Ms. Braze, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And just one question before I begin, because I'm uncertain if this part was deleted, but is the part on vital records on page 100, section 10, is that still in the bill?
According to staff, Ms. Braze, no, it is not still in the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair, then I'm going to comment on page 118, the state-based risk adjustment system assessment. So that you are all aware, the ACA requires that either the states or the federal government do risk adjustment, and what they call it in their rules is individualized risk scores. And so that isn't exactly mentioned in this bill, but that's what you need to understand is happening here. And in reading over part of the rule this morning in preparation to just inform you what this means, some of the factors are demographics, diagnostics, and utilization that will be looked at on every individual in the state, because that's what the law requires and that's what the rule requires. Now, I looked at, if you look at page or line 119.2, it talks about a certain code of federal regulations, and I looked up that code, and on line 119.6, where it says encouraging favorable behavior among healthcare market participants and discouraging unfavorable behavior, in the actual rule, the final rule that HHS has, it talks about providers and health plans, not healthcare market participants. And I'm a bit concerned that healthcare market participants is going to mean individuals in this case, because there's no definition of healthcare market participants, and that could be everybody who enrolls. And so my concern is that the language has been changed from the federal rule. And in addition, lines 119.12 through 14, I actually don't see those in the federal rule. And so it seems to me that they've been added unless they have been taken from somewhere else. And then if you go to line 120.4, it talks about looking at whether additional data or identifiers have the potential to strengthen the Minnesota-based risk adjustment approach. And so my concern here is perhaps that the committee doesn't understand that everybody is going to get an individualized risk score by the government according to demographics. And we don't exactly know what those demographics could be, but they could be all sorts of information, not just your address or your name, but also characteristics about you, whether it's your sex, your age, your gender, your disability, race, ethnicity, whatever that data might be. And that it'll be according to your utilization, and it will be according to your diagnoses. And so we're concerned about this move just all in general, but the fact that the department is going to look at the potential of actually having it be identifiable when the HHS doesn't want it to be identifiable is a concern for us. The rule says, the federal rule says that identifiers are not to be attached. So my concern is that this language, even the study saying that they should look for the possibility of using identifiers, is actually in opposition to the federal rule itself and goes above and beyond the federal rule. So I bring that to your attention lest you did not know that this is all about creating individualized risk scores on all of us, and that it looks like the department may be wanting to move beyond where HHS even says to go. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Ms. Brace. Questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question's not for Mr. or Ms. Brace, but for the bill author or his phone-a-friends, I guess, maybe. Just in general terms, other than the state-based risk assessment, but outside of that issue, are there any changes to data classifications? Is information on individuals that aren't applying for a license being collected that's not being collected on? In other words, to what degree are we expanding the scope and authority of the department to collect data on individuals?
Representative Huntley, what do you want to call?
Well, I would, Mr. Chair, I would like to have somebody from the health department answer that.
Health department.
And Mr. Chair, this is a pretty big bill and amendment, and I know, you know, time-wise, everybody's busy. So I'm trying to ask just some really kind of big, broad questions here. And
please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, your answer, rather, to Representative Holberg's question.
Mr. Chair, Manny Munson-Regala, Assistant to the Commissioner, Department of Health.
Mr. Chair, Stefan Gildemeister, Director of the Health Economics Program in the Department of Health.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, Ms. Brace is correct that the purpose of risk adjustment is to allocate premium from carriers with healthier populations to those with sicker populations. It's intended to ensure that carriers don't get penalized for insuring a sicker set of population. In order to do that, you need to get some data about their population of the insured individuals to get a sense of what their health characteristics are. But other than their health characteristics, data about the individual's name and personal identifiers is not collected. That's not the intent of doing risk adjustment. We would also note that the proposed amendment is not about us actually doing it, but about doing an evaluation about whether or not we have the capability of doing risk adjustment here at the state level. Currently, risk adjustment is going to be conducted by the federal government. They'll be collecting the same sort of data from the health plans right now, doing their calculation and then allocating premium between the health plans. Our goal with respect to the studies to determine whether a state-based methodology might be more accurate, might be more effective, and to be blunt, might result in more dollars for the state, because one of our calculations will be to determine whether or not in doing this, if you choose, for example, to implement a basic health plan, can we generate more federal dollars?
Representative Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, this response was to the one. My question was broadly to the whole rest of the bill outside of Section 18 of Article 5, but as long as it looks like the experts for that part of the bill came to the table, I'll shift gears here for a minute and go to that. One of my concerns in this language is that the way Social Security numbers are generated is the last four digits is the highly individual identifiable number, and the first three numbers and the middle two numbers are based on where you're born, etc. And so if you have the last four digits and some basic information about an individual, you can reconstruct their Social Security number. So I have some concerns, but more importantly, on lines 119, page 119, line 22, we have that magic four words, but not limited to. So it really doesn't even matter what data sets are spelled out below there because they're not even limited to that. You could just basically say you can have anything you want. And so it really makes me uncomfortable when we see that in proposed language. You should delineate the data sets you need and get authority from the legislature to take those data sets if you're actually going to have a bill that has any protections whatsoever for individuals' medical privacy. I think the on lines 6 and 7 of 119, the encouraging favorable behavior and discouraging unfavorable behavior. I don't even know what that means, but we heard over and over and over again from Representative Adkins when he carried the health care exchange bill that individual medical records would not be collected as part of this. And while certainly this is not part of his bill, we see already efforts to take individual medical information and put it under the jurisdiction of MNSHRE, Health, Human Service, and Commerce like we never have before. And I think people, again, we have short time. This is a major policy issue on whether or not we're going to provide this latitude of access to individuals' medical records for this purpose. I would be a strongly in opposition to doing this, especially with the broad language included on line 22 of page 119.
Thank you, Representative Holbert. Other questions or comments from members of the committee? Okay. Seeing none, then, are there other members of the public who wish to be heard on this House file as amended?
Mr. Chair, I never got my first question answered. In the rest of the bill, with all this licensing and data, are we exchanging more information or giving access to additional information that's not allowed under current law? What is changing in hundreds of pages of the bill? What are the departments able to do if this bill passes that they're not able to do now? And do they have access to any information without the data subject's permission or notice that they don't have now?
Please introduce yourself for the record, and please answer Representative Holbrook's question if you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director of the Compliance Monitoring Division in the Health Department. And I can respond to your question regarding Article 4, which is the home care provider licensing changes. And there are the four data practices sections right at the at the front of the article, which are really clarifying. They're what we're doing now, but we didn't have a very good explanation for providers about what data we're taking for what reason, how it will be kept, and just according to the standard definitions in Chapter 13, private, confidential, and public.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, just to try and be expedient here, are you expanding access? Are you getting information without a Tennyson? Are you changing the way you do business in any way?
Ms. Winkleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, no, there are many changes in the way that we are structuring the license. However, the data practices provisions were just updated and clarified for the new structure.
Representative Holbert.
And Mr. Chair, is there anybody that wants to comment to the changes in Articles 1, 2, 3, 5, and 6?
Anyone who wants to comment on the articles as stated by Representative Holbert? Ms. Cleveland, can you testify to that? Okay. Ms. Plummer-Zarratt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Holbert, Laura Plummer-Zarratt from the Department of Human Services Licensing Division and the Office of Inspector General. First of all, I'll speak to the background studies area in Article 2. And I spoke earlier about the MNSIS provision, and we already have access to that. That is creating, as I explained, kind of an ongoing interface with MNSIS for purposes of doing that. The other area is obtaining access to the predatory offender registration, which is part of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which we do have access to now with the BCA. The predatory offender registration would be new. What we will need to do is modify our privacy notice that we give to background study subjects to incorporate that. So that is new. And that is part of the federal grant that I referenced earlier as well. And then with regard to the other licensing provisions, I would echo Ms. Winkleman's comments in terms of the health department. What we are doing in this bill is developing the second phase of the home and community-based services standards. The first phase was passed last session. This is required by CMS as part of the corrective action plan. We currently have Chapter 245B, which governs the developmental disabilities waivers. So it really parallels those provisions for the data practices, respective notice, maintenance of records, documentation, disclosure, all of those provisions that are in our licensing laws, really under 245A, B, and applicable rules. But then it's expanding it to those services that are not currently licensed that will be under 245D.
Representative Holberg? Okay, thank you. Representative Neuberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question here I'm going to throw out to either the committee or one of our testifiers. But if I recall, when we were hearing the health care exchange bill, am I not mistaken that information and data sets gathered through the healthcare exchange can be shared with federal agencies basically at their discretion, correct?
Who is that a question for, Mr. Neuberger?
I'm just calling upon the collective memory here of our committee. If I recall correctly, when we went through the healthcare exchange, part of the data collection process, that information through the healthcare exchange was open to federal agencies above us here on the state level.
My recollection, Representative Neuberger, is that information would only be submitted to the federal government for verification of federal benefits and would not be retained by the federal government. If that has changed since then, someone could repeat. Representative Huntley.
If I remember correctly, Mr. Chair and Representative Neuberg, the exchange itself is not going to collect identified named individuals. They may get a look at what the person's medical record is, but they won't know which person that is. And then they could, because when you do a risk adjustment, you have to know the illness level of the people in the various groups. But the exchange itself would not know who that individual was.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern here is this, as I look at this, this looks like we are creating a loophole. Prove me wrong, that we could be creating a loophole here where we talk about on 119.6 where we are encouraging favorable or unfavorable behavior. We haven't defined what that is. We go down here to 119.30 where we are collecting the last four digits of a Social Security number. We're creating risk scores on individuals. And then also on 119.22 we also have that catch-all, which reminds me of the famous dot, dot, dots after spending bills. But this is data. It says including but not limited to. And then we wrap all this up in a package that potentially could be shared with any federal agency through the healthcare exchange. Mr. Chair, I don't like this, and I'm opposed to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. Any questions from members? Okay, seeing none, then Chair renews his motion that House File 1780 be recommended to pass as amended to be re-referred to the Committee on Rules. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And Representative Bly, the committee appreciates your patience. We did not anticipate that we would go an hour and a half on that bill, but it was necessary because there were a lot of moving parts. So thank you. I understand you have testifiers. I have six testifiers in favor and one testifier in opposition. If testifiers could please keep their comments brief, but the chair will move House File 338 that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. Representative Bly, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your indulgence, and we will try to keep our testimony brief. This provision has to do with existing law called By the Farm Law, which has its roots in the 1970s with a dispute over power lines going across the state and property rights. And what we're discovering in the as farmers who are experiencing their lives being really turned upside down by the bringing of this power line across their property, and as they struggle to make decisions about their future, they're finding it more difficult to make use of the provision. In one of the committee hearings that's gone forward, the original author of the bill, Mr. Miriam, did comment that it did not seem as though the bill was being applied in a way that was the original intention. And the bill tries to address some of the issues that that have emerged as problems for farmers, one being their interest in being able to move on from this area and be able to start their enterprises somewhere else, and they're finding disagreement about the value of their property, and so there's a provision to delete some language that muddies the waters around that. And then they're also wanting to make sure that they can have an answer to their desire to pursue the by the farm provision in a timely manner, and we're finding that there's delays in the current language. So there's some language being added to address that. I also have a provision because in talking to many farmers, they've asked that there be a possibility for an ombudsman to guide them through this process. However, I've learned that there may be some difficulties with, even though the way the bill is written, the project, the cost of that provision would be paid for by the project bringers. If it were possible, you know, with an author's amendment to remove Section 2, I would do that because I'm understanding that the Department of Ag has some concerns about added costs in doing that. I do have a commitment from the Department of Ag to work through that in the interim if possible. So I guess my first question is it possible to, with an author's amendment, just remove that section, or should I wait until it does have to go to one more committee? I could do it in that committee as well.
Well, Representative Bly, I would say hold off on that for now. Let's
All right.
Just go to your testifiers.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chairman Lesch, members of the committee. My name is Rod Crass. I'm an attorney and practice in the area of eminent domain condemnation, and have, along with several other folks who practice in the same area, proposed and the addressing of what has become a serious problem in the CapEx 2020 projects that are going across Minnesota with 345,000 volt lines that are being constructed literally as we speak. And the problem that we're attempting to address, along with a couple of smaller timing issues that I don't really believe are particularly controversial, but the big problem is that the utilities in question, CapEx 2020, a consortium of 11 utilities led by NSP, which has over half the project, they take the position that when people make an election under what's called the By the Farm statute to have all of their property condemned, that they are doing so voluntarily and therefore are not entitled to the same benefits and rights that property owners whose property is taken by the state or the county or the school district for whatever public reason is appropriate, that they receive. That is to say, there's a difference in the damages available to property owners whose property are condemned under the By the Farm statute, as opposed to any other use of condemnation in the state of Minnesota under our laws. This position, we contend, is not what the bill intended, and I've asked, and I think you have a copy of former Senator Merriam's comments before the Senate Energy Committee, and where he talks about that, and I'd commend that to your reading when you have a chance. And he talks about what the intent was. He talks about what was happening back in the 1970s with the last major 345,000 vote line that went through Minnesota. There was a great deal of civil unrest and unhappiness with the procedure, and the legislature addressed that issue with the Buy the Farm Law and said, we're going to give you the opportunity, farmers, homeowners, people who have hobby farms, when you are impacted by one of these huge lines of, they've set the limit at 200,000 volts or higher, when you're impacted by one of those lines, we're going to let you tell the utility you have to condemn all of our property. We call it buy the farm. It really should be condemn the farm, because that's the right the legislature has given people. And once that happens under the statute says all procedures shall be conducted in accordance with Chapter 117, the condemnation law, and it also says that once the property owner makes that election, the effort of the utility to condemn only an easement will be converted automatically by law into a total taking. And so, therefore, the total taking rules of Chapter 117 should apply. In particular, ones that have been highly fought by CapEx 2020 are rights to relocation and rights to minimum compensation, minimum comp being one of the additional benefits the legislature placed in the law in 2006 with that major overhaul. So that is the main issue, and I'm here to tell you that the people impacted don't believe in for a minute that this is a voluntary relinquishment of their property. These, and perhaps some of you have farm backgrounds, certainly all of you know people who farm. You know the relationship between farmers and their land, and I mean literally the earth, the soil that they have. And they don't make this decision because they're looking for a way to unload their dairy farm or their hog enterprise or their corn farm if they're growing crops. They're doing it because they feel they have no choice because of the impacts of this type of a high voltage line. And consequently, the last thing they want to do, if you ask them, they'd say, don't give us any money, take your line away. Don't impact my hogs. Don't impact my dairy herd, because I know you're going to, and that's why you've given me no choice but to exercise this right to make you condemn the entire parcel.
Thank you, Mr. Cross.
And so that's what we're talking about, and if I could, I'm going to turn over the microphone to the next.
You absolutely can. Is it Ms. Schwartz?
Yes.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Julie Schwartz, and I live in Sibley County. My husband and I, along with our children, we run a 100-cow dairy and 575 acres, and all but one of our farms is directly impacted by this line. It's going through the middle of 175 acres, and it's going alongside of our home place, 160 acres. This line, we have a long driveway, and a third of a mile of our driveway, this line runs alongside our driveway. And these arms are 15 feet out. That means every time we go up and down our driveway, every time we get our mail, every time we go to the field, to town, we have to drive directly under this transmission line. And I'm talking about the wires. Our driveway curves around and goes up by our house and our dairy. And between our driveway and where this transmission line is, we have two machine sheds, we have a grain bin set up, our shops, and we have two cement pads where we
put our feed bags on for our dairy when we mix feed. So twice a day, every day, we have to go either underneath these transmission lines or alongside it just to mix our feed. We went out to Wisconsin to talk to some dairy farmers that are are living with it. I think 8-10 years ago they went through this, and their cows are about the same distance, except they have field in between where we have absolutely nothing, as I just said. Their cows, they had cows die, calves die, cows abort. It took 6 to 10 breedings to keep a cow pregnant. The husband, well, they went from a 27,000-pound herd average, which back then was a tremendous herd, probably one of the top in the state, down to 16. Their somatic cell went skyrocket to this day. They're on a watch list for 400,000 because, as you know, well, you might be aware of that's a number that they're trying to say, if you go above that, you're on a watch list. If you can't keep them below it, they won't buy your milk anymore. Because of a cross in Europe. The husband's whole body at times will break out in a rash because of the stray voltage, and his wife has some reaction not quite as that effect. Another thing is about the day of the easement, the condemnation of our easement, which in our case was May 9th of 2012, so the land values go back to that time. From then up to now, land values have gone up tremendously by thousands of dollars. So if this bill doesn't get passed and we don't get the minimum compensation and the relocation costs, we will have to go to our lender and say for the same land base, we need thousands, millions of dollars more just to keep our same land base, to keep our same acres. And lastly, in CapEx's own paperwork and the flyers they send out, they say these lines can affect pacemakers, implantable defibrillators, artificial limb screws, and pins. My husband has an artificial hip, and unfortunately he's on the striker recall list. Unfortunately, we found out he has to have it redone. It'll be 3 years in June, and he has to have it done next month. Our doctor asked how far away is our house, and our house is roughly about 400 feet. He said it's too close. No hesitation whatsoever. Like I said, it's in their paperwork. We know we're too close. They talk about the safe distance being away from this line. We don't have a safe distance. We are underneath and alongside of this line. There's no safe distance for us. This is, as CapEx will probably tell you, 700 miles going through our state, dissecting our state. This isn't just a small group of people. This is people, Minnesotans throughout our whole state are being affected by this. I guess what we're really imploring that you consider this bill strongly. There's people that have waited for over 2 years, tried to hold two mortgages just to be able to move on, and because of the delay tactics, they can't move on. We can't keep moving on if we don't have money to buy another place. And as Rod Crass said, this isn't a choice of ours. We would rather have them moved away from us. We realize somebody's going to be affected by it. It's not what we want at all. We want our farm will be a century farm in 8 years. It's very difficult when you're looking at that and you have generations, your kids, that planned on being part of this and changing their lives because of it. So I guess we're just, please consider passing this bill. It's urgent to do it now so that people can move on with their lives. It can't wait. I guess that's my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony, really, Ms. Schwartz. When I guess it was XL Energy, I don't know what power company put it in, did they tell you anything about this when they put it in?
They give you information, and then they say the further away you are, the safer you are. They don't really give you exact distances. They'll talk about microwaves, all these things that have EMFs. As far as EMFs go, they go through buildings. There's no stopping EMFs, which is what causes, to my understanding, a lot of the cancers and a lot of the problems, that health risks. I don't know, did I answer your question?
Yeah, you did. Absolutely. Thank you. There's another testifier. Are there any other testifier proponents? There's one other? Okay. Sir, you're down at the table right now. Please introduce yourself for the record, begin your testimony. And please keep your testimony brief, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I want to assure you that nothing about this is voluntary. Our family farm.
Please introduce yourself for the record, sir.
I'm sorry, Dave Minar.
Thank you.
Our family's been farming on this land since 1926. Currently, we have an organic grass-fed dairy farm. Our farm's named Cedar Summit Farm. We also have a creamery on our farm. We deliver milk all over the Twin Cities and the Upper Midwest. There's several issues here. We have about close to a mile of the power line going across land that we either own or lease. And most of that land has electric fences under the power line. And so we don't know what kind of effect it's going to have. We have employees and family members moving poly wire, sectioning off different pastures, sections of pasture. Most of the time they'll be working underneath power lines. So we don't know, even if we turn our fencer off, if they're going to get a jolt or not. We're not sure. There's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of unknowns. We don't know about the soil. We don't know about our production, our herd production. There's also issues of aesthetics. We have a lot of farm tours, and we host a lot of dinners on the farm, on our farm, and having 150-foot tall power lines there obviously isn't a very, very pleasing sight. For us to we're going to end up probably moving because of all these issues. We don't know where, because ours is an organic dairy farm, and we need to move into another organically certified property because it takes a 3-year conversion. And if we just buy a conventional farm, we'll be basically out of business for 3 years because we won't be able to sell our milk as organic. So that those are all issues that we're faced with. So I urge you to consider this bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr.
Thank
Benar.
You. Thank you very much.
Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
My name is Mark Melsha. My wife, Jane, and I have raised our 3 children on a beautiful 5-acre building site 2 miles north of Arlington in Sibley County. I'm actually Julie's neighbor. We're real close to each other, so we've been supporting each other on this. I run an excavating company on site, on this 5-acre site, so I have a shop, sheds, a big yard to turn around with the equipment. I have big dozers and excavator, scrapers, stuff. So I've been here 30 years, and I've developed this whole site up to where I'm pretty well set. You know, everything's the way I want it. Like I said, we've been living here for 30 years, and we built everything new on site. We also planted many evergreen and ash trees that have matured over the years. Many of our trees have been removed for this project, leaving our house open to the south and west, whereas before we had trees there and it was very beautiful. We have done many improvements over the years, thinking we were going to retire here and enjoy the privacy and wildlife we encounter. The CapEx power line is now 78 feet from my house. This has been a central location for my business, so we need to stay in this area. We've been searching for 2 years for a site we can develop with no luck. It has been a stressful period for our family, not knowing what the future holds. CapEx claims we voluntarily chose to buy the farm. My family believes we had no other choice. We hope that you can get this bill passed so we can receive adequate compensation to relocate. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Melsha. There being no other testimony proponents, we do have Mr. Steve Quam, testifier in opposition.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Quam. I am the counsel for the CapEx Land Rights Division. I'm an attorney at Frederickson and Byron. And I think as the committee considers this bill, it needs to step back a second and get a little context. Entities with the power of eminent domain typically exercise it to construct public improvement projects. So let's assume that as an 80-acre parcel, okay? And now let's assume you need 100 feet across the southern edge and your MnDOT. What happens? Well, MnDOT acquires that southern 50 feet. The person who lives on the farm is entitled to just compensation, which is value of the easement taken and any diminution to what remains. Now let's assume a pipeline crosses that southern 50 feet. What happens? Exactly the same thing. Now let's assume there's a 200 kilovolt power line. What rights does the landowner have? Well, under the By the Farm statute, a landowner, provided the election is reasonable, can force the utility to expand the taking to the entire 80 acres. Okay? So landowners who are crossed by high voltage utilities have more rights than any other person who is subject to a condemnation action. As it is, this is a law, and these are rights that are unlike, that I'm aware of, any in the United States. We there? Now, what this bill tries to do is say, okay, you can choose to stay, or you can choose to go, as I understand it. If you choose to go, you're not entitled, you're entitled not only to expand the taking, but you're entitled to additional compensation, extra compensation, other than the fair market value of the piece that was elected. And this goes to what's called as minimum compensation. It's not really minimum compensation. It's section 117.187, and that provides that a landowner who must relocate as a result of a taking is entitled to a sum that's sufficient to purchase comparable property in the community. Extra. How much extra? Well, we've seen cases where it's two times fair market value, three times fair market value. So what this bill says is if you decide to move, you don't only get fair market value. You get to make a claim for what could be twice fair market value, three times fair market value. You get to make that claim. Take it one step further. If you look at the bill and the language in the bill, there's a provision that obligates the utility to sell the land that was acquired for the market value it paid. Well, market value is different than minimum compensation. We have a situation where the utility will be required to pay two times fair market value for an 80-acre parcel, then obligated to sell it for the fair market value. There's a huge swing. Compare that to what MnDOT would pay for the very same easement. And it's not just an easement across the south. It can be a 0.7-acre easement at the very corner that doesn't affect the property. It can be expanded. MnDOT would pay perhaps $15,000 for the half acre. There's a situation where it's an 80-acre farm where a utility could pay $500,000. Third point, Supreme Court is currently considering whether the minimum compensation statute as it's currently drafted, whether it applies to persons who elect under By the Farm. The matter was argued 2 weeks ago, and it's currently pending. House Research Council can provide background regarding the cases that have addressed this statute, which is unique, and they can also provide background regarding specifically what the Supreme Court's considering and how it will affect this bill. Fourth point, and this is my final one, members of the committee. This bill does create process. We have no objection to adding process to the bill. I think it's beneficial for both sides. We've been in communications with Mr. Crass, and we can craft language that I think this will work. I think we can make it better. Any questions for the members from the members of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Quam. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you've negotiated some of these settlements already, what's the average length of time from them identifying that they want to choose buy the farm option and to the settlement and having that purchase completed? And can you also relate that to the timing of the construction of the power line coming across?
Mr. Quam.
Mr. Chair, under the existing law, there's a case called NSP v. Williams, which provides that after a utility receives one of these elections, they can object to the election as being unreasonable at any time prior to the hearing for compensation. That could be 6 months, that could be 9 months. The utilities and the Owners' Council have recognized that that doesn't work. What we've done is we've agreed to put into the orders granting the petition for the easement that the utility will respond to the election within 30 days after the order is issued, okay? So the utility will respond and either accept the election or identify why they're objecting within 30 days. At that point, either side can bring it to the district court for resolution. So depending on the will of either side, that affects the timing of when that's resolved. Second part of your question is, have we been able to negotiate resolutions of buy the farmhouses and get people moved? We have. Sometimes it's happened before the line's been energized, sometimes after.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Quam. Any other testimony from members of the public? And seeing none, then I will renew my motion that House File 338 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Lesh.
Thank you for your patience waiting around. Representative Holberg moves House File 1756 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Rules. Representative Holberg, you have an A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I do.
Thank you. In order to get the bill in the shape the author so desires, all in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You may recall this year we had the pleasure of seeing Ms. Frazier come to the table to testify with concerns on a variety of bills and how the data classifications in various proposals would affect the Safe at Home program. As I reviewed the chapter of law that established the Safe at Home program and Chapter 13, it was pretty apparent that there was really a lack of structure and guidance on the data provisions or policies and ramifications for the Safe at Home program. We had a number of meetings with the Secretary of State's office over the Easter break and have been talking to advocates trying to address the concerns that the location address in particular of people that are in this program would be kept private, and it's a safety issue, and we think we're probably maybe 90% of the way there. I think there'll be some opposition or concern testimony. We would certainly continue to work on it, but basically we put in place a structure where the classification of the data would follow along with the registration in the program. I believe it's a 4-year duration, and then participants in the program are contacted numerous times and told to re-up. And how this program works is that the actual location or address where a person works or goes to school and lives are shielded, and they actually use a P.O. box number in which the mechanics of receiving mail go through this P.O. Box number, and mail goes to that location, and then an employee of the Secretary of State's office and the Safe at Home program re-forwards the mail, et cetera, to that particular location. They told us stories of even when requesting help of law enforcement insisting that they provide their home address and calls for service, et cetera. So we tried to make it clear that individuals in this program cannot be required to disclose the address in which they live in order to receive any services. And we'd be happy to stand for questions. I would defer to Representative Simon. He has a Safe at Home bill that's on the House floor. We appreciate the committee's time to have testimony on this issue, but I think the intent of this is that at some point we would take this language or what's finally agreed to and amend it on to Representative Simon's bill on the House floor, and he can correct me if I'm misunderstood.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for holding this hearing on this bill, because even though we could have had a few people in the room making this decision than just adding it on the floor, we thought it best, and particularly Representative Holberg thought it best, to ask for hearing on this so we could say that it's been vetted, heard, the public has gotten notice about this, so that when House File 580 comes up on the floor, which it will in the next couple of weeks, which is a related safe-at-home bill having to do with changing some of the standards and updating. We heard it in this committee. We passed it. There was no controversy. The idea is we will, in essence, be amending what we agreed to today in 1756 onto that bill as an amendment, but we'll be able to say on the floor that this was thoroughly heard and vetted. This isn't an on-the-fly major change just being done on the floor. So I appreciate Representative Holberg's work, hours of work, I have to say. I've heard that she and the Secretary of State's office have invested in order to come up with this product. And the idea, as Representative Holberg said, is so that we don't have to have this piecemeal approach where on every bill someone from the Secretary of State's office has to come and carve out a special exception for the Safe at Home program. Hopefully, going forward, this will save us a lot of time in the future. So thank you, Representative Holberg.
Any other questions, comments from members?
Me? You?
You. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious on line 1.17, there's an effective date of January 1st, 2014. It appears to be in reference to the classification of data. Is there a particular reason why that's set so far into the future? Or is just that just allowing the program to get up and running?
Representative Holberg?
Mr. Chair, that would allow for time to get everybody on the same page, if you will. But if you want to.
Mr. Chair, Claire Wilson, the Office of the Secretary of State. Yes, I think that was just to allow enough time, and if I remember correctly, maybe get us in alignment with the reporting period. But that section just refers to sort of the classification of data and moving some and making Chapter 5 be in alignment with Chapter 13.
Other questions, comments from members? Then Ms. Hugdahl, please introduce yourself for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. Certainly want to thank the Secretary of State's office and Representative Holberg. We've been chatting with them about the language of the bill, and we are certainly supportive of the goal of the overall bill. I'm in this committee a fair amount, as many of you know, too, and I'm well aware, as Representative Simon points out, that as multiple bills come through, there's always a discussion about making an exception for safe at home, and so we've talked about this at length, and we're very supportive of this program. It's an outstanding program that has had a great bipartisan support over the years, and many of you know that from talking about this over the years. It's been just a lifesaver, literally, for some of our clients who are enrolled in this program. So we're very supportive of the program. We only really have one concern, and it is subdivision, 3B, which is lines 2.17 through 2.20 on page 2 of the bill. And that relates to when someone leaves the program, that the data that was withheld and shielded while they were in the program becomes public. And so that is the piece that we have a concern about. Again, this is data that can be the actual address or locational information relating to the person's home, work, or school. So basically, there are really kind of three concerns that spring from this. And one is when a person enters the program currently, there is, and the whole point of the program, as it should be, is about shielding information. And so people, upon leaving the program, have kind of had this expectation that this data will be private. And then to have it disclosed after they leave, it really kind of changes some of the nature of being in this program. Quickly, the other piece of it, too, that we have some concern about is there are cases where if a person goes into the program, they may have friends or family who have been helping them, maybe telling their former spouse or whoever it is they fear that they don't know where they are. And it's possible that through some of this disclosure, someone would then discover, oh, by the way, now I see that the address they were living at is right next door to your brother who's been telling me for 4 years that he has no idea where you are. So it does start kind of opening the door to in some other aspects that we have some concerns about. There's also the possibility, too, and I know many of you know because of the data practices issues, that it's not always the request of the person that you fear. There are a lot of people who data mine, and that's their full-time occupation, and they're asking for loads of data from all over the place. And when that data is mined and put up there, if that information gathers up in it, it's once it's out of that hand and into the public domain, no one really has any control of where it goes. And so somebody from classmates.com may get information and put it up on the internet as a history of where people have lived. I know you can look up all kinds of people on the internet and see who their relatives are and where they live, and you can pay $10 and get more information. So that's kind of the concern we have, is it all kind of relates around the expectation of privacy, which is fairly fundamental to the program. And so we look forward to talking more with Representative Holberg and the Secretary of State's office, but we wanted to put out there that that's our concern with it, is that this is such a special privacy-protected population that we really want to err on the side of being very careful with folks' data, even as we understand that there are folks who have left the program. Maybe they return later, but we do want to be really cautious about that. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would kind of echo that concern, because if a person has been living at a facility that is a shelter facility or a home that's used kind of as a safe home, I would think that this provision might open up other participants to danger, and you know, in the identifying of where that location was.
Representative Scott.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might, I think what people have to keep in mind, and certainly I'm willing to work with the advocates, and I'm not minimizing their concern in any way, shape, or form, but people have to remember that the classification is when the request is made. So if somebody was in a shelter and left and wasn't in the Safe at Home program, and say you were looking for utility records or whatever, it would not show like past addresses or whatever. So this, the way that we thought about this was that every 4 years they have to re-up into the program, and it is the participant's responsibility from the very beginning to make contact with those that have data on them to let them know that they're a member of the Safe at Home program and to shield that information. What the robber, the issue that we haven't quite resolved here, is that if they don't re-up into the program, then they're no longer in the Secretary of State's program. And so we thought for data management purposes, et cetera, that to have that expiration occur at the same time and to put up probably a higher burden on the Secretary of State's office, which they're willing to take on, of educating participants what the ramifications are if they don't re-up into the program, that was a tighter management of the data than just what's happening now, in that when they're not in the program, it reverts to its original classification anyway. So it puts some structure and some standards for local units of government, et cetera, to put ticklers in their system, and so that there's not inadvertent slip-ups of information.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious why someone would leave the program if they still felt unsafe in having their data out there. Is there certain criteria that they have to meet to stay in the program? And if so, what is that? I just can't imagine that if I'm concerned about this person still finding out where I am, why would I ever leave the program?
Let's ask that. Ms. Hugdahl?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I'll take a swing at it. And sure. I know Ms. Wilson is my definite phone a friend. On it, there may be a variety of reasons why people leave the program. I mean, some of it may be that with this concept of certification, their certification lapses, and it may be that they, despite notices, there may be unusual cases where there's a gap between when they do re-enroll. That's a possibility. There may be people, if you leave the state of Minnesota and move somewhere else, you cannot stay in the Minnesota program. You have to go to the new into the new state's program if you so choose. Not all of them, unfortunately, are as well done as Minnesota's. Mm-hmm. So there are some of those folks as well. So there's no one particular reason. Certainly there may be people who intentionally leave the program and have no, you know, reason to need to be in the program any longer. Maybe because they feel like 4 years of not being traceable has given them enough time and distance, which again reopens our question of, but now if we're reopening the place they've been, does that give enough connecting the dots to someone where they might have felt like they had enough distance with that 4 year time or 8 year time or whatever. I think that's the place we're all kind of struggling with.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Any other testifiers on this? Okay. Ms. Palmer, Ms. Moses, and Mr. Neumeister. Ms. Palmer, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I'm just here to echo Ms. Hugdahl's comments, and we also thank Representative Holberg for her willingness to talk about this further, and we look forward to coming up with a good resolution. I'm just going to briefly tell the committee that MnCASA represents over 70 sexual assault victim advocacy programs across the state. Safety planning is a huge issue for the victims that are served in these programs, and the Safe at Home program plays a big role in securing them as they move through their process. We are concerned that the reclassification could pose a safety issue and that could contradict the intent of the program. We believe that we could work to a resolution, though, to hopefully find a way that we can protect the program participants and continue to support the Safe at Home program, which we believe does terrific work for the victims here in the state. That's really all I wanted to add, but we thank you for your attention to this, and we look forward to finding a good solution.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Paul. Moses?
Thank you, Chair Lesh and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Moses, and I represent the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. We're an association of over 80 agencies that provide domestic violence services to victims and their children. And I think, as has been said here, control over personally identifying information for victims is key to safety. We really do thank Representative Holberg, as well as the Secretary of State's office and the committee for seeing the importance of this issue. And Minnesota really is a national leader on this issue, having some of the best legislation in the nation around address confidentiality programs. And while we support the overall policy goal of increasing protections for privacy and confidentiality of victim data, we do have some concerns. For instance, what types of disclosures and information will be presented to a victim when enrolling? The expectation of privacy is implicit in this program, and being certified in the program comes with an understanding that the information disclosed by the victim will be held as private data. And since this is happening at such a time of great vulnerability, and since maybe a person starts to feel safe in the 4 years, they may not be thinking about the implications of certification or recertification. Something may happen that kind of distracts them from that. So we look forward to continuing to engage in conversations to continue this vital program as it protects survivors. More than anything, we want to make sure that the victims who are most vulnerable aren't harmed if we were to get privacy issues wrong. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony as well. Mr. Neumeister.
Your phone, ma'am. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I believe that we should not have continuously secret files. The way that this could be in terms of the discussion about information that should be public, after a certain amount of time, if it doesn't involve anything, I think it, at least maybe the identity should be public, to where the public can see how effective this program is. Is that a major point that I'm going to hamper on? No. But I think it's just that, you know, from my understanding is, it's private for 4 years. If it up, you re-up, or you don't re-up, at least some of the information becomes public. I think there's just a public accountability kind of aspect. to that. The second item is that if you look on page 4 of the bill, on lines 4-6, you make exception to the general provision of law enforcement records where if there's a crime happening. Now, granted, the legislature has a policy, and I've worked on a lot of these over the years. You know, mandated reporters is private. The identity of that is private. A victim of a sexual assault and those types are private. The identity is. But on lines 4-6, 4-7, I just point that out. The public would not be able to find out who and what, you know, and all kinds of, this could be all kinds of crimes, not necessarily serious crimes where you've already set as policy the name of the identity of the person should be private. The third item is on 4-14, 4-17. This is an item, again, I have done a lot of work on. I'm trying to figure out if it's important for law enforcement to do their job, why would you want to have this information be exempted from being able to be exchanged between law enforcement entities? So those are my 3 points, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Meister. Representative Holberg, what is your desire with this? Do you want this passed to rules and to work on these changes between here and rules, or do you want this laid over and work on these changes before we next meet?
Mr. Chair, I would defer to whatever you would prefer. I'd like to at least also have an opportunity to respond to some of the testimony as well. But
okay.
I'm good with either option. I don't know what Representative Simon, if he has a preference. I don't know the timeline to when his bill will actually be brought up on the House floor. I don't see any representatives from League of Minnesota Cities is here. I don't know if they have any concerns. I think first of all, the issue about sharing amongst law enforcement, unfortunately, some of these dangerous people are actually in law enforcement and use their position in law enforcement to locate people or help their buddies locate people, and so that's why we tighten down some of the access of law enforcement. I think that the concerns expressed about the four-year the expiration of the certification and the change of the data classification, that's really what's happening now. I mean, if you're not in the program, you don't have the protections. And I view the language in the bill as more putting into law the processes and procedures on, hey, we need to think about this and deal with it and have a process. And so I think if people are contemplating a forever classification for a one-time enrollment in the program, I think that's a change from what the current policy is and would probably benefit from some testimony around that. So I don't have a problem with the bill being laid over.
Okay. Well, that's what the chair's intention will be then, Representative Holberg. For that, Representative Paymar.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you're going to lay the bill over, I guess we don't have to try to fix it then. I was just going to suggest on page 2 that we, on subdivision 3, that we delete B. Frankly, I don't know why you need, the obvious intent of this program was to provide safety to victims of domestic and sexual violence, and it's quite obvious that the most dangerous time for victims is fleeing an abusive partner, and so I don't know why we would want to reclassify the data as public. The person has enrolled in the program. If they decide to leave for whatever reason, so be it. So why should the data be public? And I just don't understand it, and I don't know if that solves it, but if
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymer, that actually makes it worse, because it goes without saying, if it's not classified, it falls back to the general standards of Chapter 13. And so I'm guessing that people are in the program are thinking that because they let a community know 3.5 years ago that they're part of the program, that their location would never become public. But if they don't stay in the program, it will, if they're still at that same location. So in some ways, this actually helps provide more protection, because it lets them know, if you don't re-up, you're going to lose these protections.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know. I don't know if you want to try to fix it now, or you want to just deal with it later.
Representative Holder, circle back with Representative Paymer on that as you're working through this during the county debate bill. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's really kind of the interaction of Part A and Part B that ends up being the issue here, because Part A has a phrase that says, and any future identity and location data received. And it's really that future data that it needs to be clear will become public. But it would be nice if we could protect the past data for some of the sake of some of the issues that have been raised about other people that might be affected. So I think working between those two paragraphs might be the thing.
Any other questions for Representative Holder? Then, seeing none, Chair lays the bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Representative Holder. Members, there being no other business before committee,
You're way off on that.
Before for today,
committee is adjourned.